Very nice and gracious introduction. I will thank you very much for the invitation to talk to this. I've never attended any of the goings-on of the Johns Hopkins workshops, so it's nice to be involved for the first time. The title is, I think, fairly transparent. There we go. And I would like to start off by paraphrasing a book title that came out regarding linguistics as done from MIT. It was called The View from Building 20, which is now defunct. It's where the new center at MIT is for linguistics and AI and several other departments, the Stata Center. But it was a collection in honor of Hale and Kaiser and others doing lexical research for many years in the tradition of Chomsky and generative tradition. And I'm taking someone who is one of Chomsky's nemesis, John Sinclair, and I think this is a very nice quote. I've used it in an article that I did with Anna Rumshisky. Starved of adequate data, linguistics languished. It became fashionable to look inwards to the mind rather than outward to society. And I think that says a lot. Let's just try to explain what it does say. What I want to do is focus on selection, verb selecting arguments. And the consequence of this is a recognition of, or the emergence of, the nouns that are in these argument spots for verbs behaving polysemously. So nouns behaving polysemously. It could be a TV show. And polysemy is systematic. There's a logic to it. But it's not quite axiomatic. And it's not deductive. So it's a really nice area to look at from a large data corpus-oriented perspective, but also it presents a really interesting challenge to probabilistic models of semantics, because polysemy is all about semantics. And one solution to handling polysemy is to introduce operations that are coercive. They're changing the type of an argument. Coercion is also not fixed and immutable or inviolable. It changes in context. It's licensed by a variety of lexical, phrasal, constructional, sentential, but then unfortunately discourse and contextual factors. So it's pretty clear from all this, and I think we can agree, that linguistic modulations reflect conceptual shifts in thought. I throw that in there because it is one of the goals, I believe, of this week's workshop, the prelim, to think in terms of larger and deeper ramifications for what the probabilistic, what are these conditions that we're imposing on rules or interpretations actually reflecting? Well, they're reflecting conceptualizations that we as speakers and hearers are taking advantage of and making use of. One of the things I'm going to focus on today is the inherent tension between corpus and theory. How theory is informed by corpora. In fact, we'll see theory is in need of and requires corpus data. Corpora provide us the necessary raw data, to come up with the actual assignments of values within a probabilistic system. So the punchline will be something like probabilistic judgments for compositional operations will be necessary. The big questions that I'll be threading through the entire talk are the ones that we all, if you deal with linguistic and lexical issues, as many of us do, you think about these all the time, so this is not unique. How do you put words together to make meanings? And how do they change in their composition? How do you explain creative word use? And what is creative word use? How can linguistic models account for this type of variety in language use, in the way that words and phrases change their senses? So I'm just going to lay out some assumptions that many of these problems are only interesting if we assume language is compositional. Now, that can mean a lot of things. It's not necessarily strict Monegovian, Fragean, Tarskian compositionality, but it is conceptually, I think, a very nice guiding line to start with and then see where things diverge away from compositionality. It's in addition to being a desirable facet of, I think, cognitive or conceptual assumptions or models, I think it's a desirable property of semantics. And it has good results, and I think there are computational consequences that are also quite desirable. As I was just pointing to and hinting at, though, many phenomena in language seem to be completely non-compositional, and we'll examine some of those. The work I've been doing with colleagues over the last too many years has, generative lexicon, has introduced a variety of richer representations and richer mechanisms to account for what appear to be non-compositional processes, to enhance the underarching infrastructure that gives you meaning. But the fact is, and hence my interest in this talk being here today, in this week, in this month, is it seems that semantics of words seems to encode probabilistic conditions on type selection, and not just be-all and end-all. So the models that we have, whatever they are, have to accommodate such observed behavior. And so GL has to do that too. So the probabilistic notions that I'm just introducing need to be added to that. So let's just kind of start off with what a probabilistic semantics would be. This comes from a paper that Jan and Shalom did in 2013. So they make a distinction between two theses, which actually come from Emin Bach's 1986 paper, what he calls Chomsky's thesis, which is natural languages can be described as formal systems. And Emin then goes on to talk about what Montague's contribution to this would be, his thesis being that natural languages can be described as interpreted formal systems. And then what Van Eyck and Lapin introduce is what they call the Harris-Jelinek thesis. Natural languages can be described as information theoretic systems using stochastic models that express the distributional properties of their elements. And that's kind of what you do. So digging down just for one slide, what this thesis implies is the language model hypothesis for syntax, which holds that our knowledge of grammar is represented as a stochastic language model. That has certain requirements. That on this hypothesis, a speaker acquires a probability distribution over the strings constituting the sentence of the language without getting into any details of the models and the distributions. But this distribution is generated by some kind of automaton, which is probabilistic, or some kind of grammar, which is probabilistic. And it assigns a structure to a string with a probability that's the product of the rules applied in the derivation of that string, yada, yada, yada. And the probability of the string itself is the sum of the parses that the grammar generates. Okay, this is all well known. This probability represents the likelihood of a sentence occurrence in a corpus. Now, given everything I just said, one of the major problems here is that lexically derived relations like synonymy, antonymy, polysemy, and hyponymy are prone to clustering and overlap effects, which can really complicate the model and complicate one's interpretations. So I'm taking this as a jumping off point to start talking about polysemy. Now, work that I've been doing with Patrick Hanks, who has a longstanding affiliation with Prague and Brno in the development of what started off at Brandeis as the corpus pattern analysis lexicon, and now is here in Czech Republic, as basically a library of sentence constructions. Patrick and I have been working recently on trying to tease apart the theoretical assumptions that linguists have made over the past 60 years or 70 years for what constitutes a datum in linguistics. And we have one, what we call NEDs, which are naturally elicited data. That's theory-driven basically an elicited utterance from the speaker, taken as the scientist. This is the Chomskyan introspective datum. And then we have what we call nods, which are naturally occurring data. And they may or may not contradict theory, but this is a strategy here that I'm actually outlining. I'm introducing two types of data and a strategy. And then there's revisions to the theory which have to account for the nods. Now, so let me just point out this one other type of data that comes from experiment in psycholinguistics. And we might think of those as experimentally elicited data. Okay, so completion, closed task, things like that, which are different than just naturally elicited data. They're kind of unnaturally elicited data, but they're still elicited. They don't just show up on your email doorstep or in your server doorstep, to paraphrase how we get our data on the web. So without going into a lot of history, I do want to just talk a little bit about the role of these forms of data in post-Bloomfieldian structuralism and then what comes to be transformational grammar. Now, I have a distinction here, which is not, it's overlapping. And we see that early on, in the early 50s, and Chomsky up to 1953, and Bar-Hillel up to 1953, in series of articles they did back and forth in language, were basically assuming kind of a post-Bloomfieldian structuralist approach to how to do data. Namely, something that we might call the use of discovery procedures. Now, discovery procedures, as we all know, as you learn in linguistics, or if you've taken any type of philosophy of science, it's in Chomsky's phrase, the theory has to provide a practical and mechanical method for actually constructing the grammar given a corpus. A decision procedure is that the theory has to provide a practical and mechanical method for determining whether or not a grammar proposed for a given corpus is the best grammar. And it's because of these types of expressions that Postol always talked about in the 70s and 80s, the best grammar, the best theory and the best grammar. Chomsky proposed in 55 and then published in 57 a shortened version of what he calls an evaluation procedure. Given a corpus and two grammars, the theory must tell us which is the better grammar of the language from which the corpus is drawn. According to Chomsky's reasoning, the evaluation procedure is a much lower bar than the decision procedure with discovery, or even just the discovery procedure. And this is predicated on one really interesting point, that namely, Chomsky is introducing, for the first time, the admission of naturally elicited data as a way to constitute and build the corpus. This was not done in European structuralism, in Bloomfieldian structuralism, or in post-Bloomfieldian work, as done by even early Chomsky and Harris and others. You didn't make up your own data. So what this now allows is the individual scientist, as it were, this in geography, we have these individual geographers. You can just basically contribute to the world of GIS by basically saying that I found a hummingbird at the particular lat long, citizen geography. Citizen linguistics is basically, I say that this sentence is wrong, or I say this sentence is right. So it's empowering. So this is what Chomsky basically introduces in 1955. The thing is that the evaluation procedure is talked about in contrast to discovery a lot, but people seem to miss the fact that he's introducing and pushing from now on the naturally elicited data. He didn't originally say that nods, naturally observable or occurring data, are not to be used, but it was kind of obvious that it was impossible at the time. Now, what are the consequences of this? Let me just spend 2 minutes on this. I've written about this elsewhere, but I think it's worth thinking about if you don't happen to know. Because you're not going to find this in Frederick Neumeier or other histories of linguistics, at least as published in the United States. In the 50s, with the introduction of naturally elicited data, Chomsky revolutionized the way structuralists looked at language. There weren't any corpora. There were no ways to ask questions. The discovery procedure is a procedure, and the decision procedure is a question one can ask over data sets. But if you don't have data, you're at a standstill. Chomsky's strategy is to generate the data and then essentially be able to ask questions that you could not ask before. There's a quote from Bach from his conversion, like his St. Paul-like conversion in 1960, which is to say that it enabled us to look at data, look at phenomena that were just completely off the map because we didn't have data for them. Questions, presumptive pronouns, which of course didn't exist, but things like that, pronouns, period. You couldn't ask these questions because the data didn't exist. So what happened? Well, along the way, it became the dogma and the religion. And never did naturally occurring data ever come back. So that's where we are now. And it's become a religion. So what I want to talk about, and we can talk about this more through the week, which I find it interesting sociologically, is the shifting and difficult nature of how to model selection. So selecting an argument via verb. I have a body, I have my arguments, and there are a lot of different approaches to this, and I've talked about this elsewhere, but I just need to bring up just the basic mechanisms here. You can have atomic predication and just have ambiguity of verbs with a lot of different arguments can just be ambiguous, even if they're not really logically related. You can add a lot of parameters like you do in certain types of logic-based approaches. You can come up with decompositions, and you can add both. Now, what we do in type theory is essentially to enrich the domain of entities. So you take little e from Montague, and you blow it up into essentially sorts that are structured via a rich type structure. And what that gives you is essentially a function which is taking as its type for a particular argument, a functional type, as one of its head types, some kind of characteristic function on the argument. And basically, it's kind of a subset of the predicates out of the body. So what it's kind of doing by subtyping, or by sortily typing the arguments, you're kind of doing a pretest. So that's what general lexicon has been for a long time. The arguments are pretests. And if an argument condition is not satisfied, then you have to have some fail statements for errors. Well, either it doesn't get interpreted or you coerce it. But when you have a probabilistic interpretation, things I think are going to get different. Arguments can now be viewed as encoding probability distributions of pretests for performing the actions and the predicates. So that's what a verb will be. That's what a functional type will be. And from what I can tell, because I'm new to this, from the probabilistic interpretations of type theory, that seems to be what Dan and Shalom and others are doing with the way they model their type theories, as far as I can tell. Now, let me just go into what the specifics of this selection are, and I'll just give some examples of how theory meets corpus. So you've got various, essentially they're like theta roles for any type of category. There's the formal, there's the constitutive, there's the telic, and there's the agentive. These are the generalized idea from Aristotle. You've probably seen these many times. You take some kind of functional typing system, where you can put all these things together. This one happens to come from work I've done with Asher. And then you can distinguish types in a very gross level by whether or not they have one of these additional tensor or dot objects. Namely, you've got naturals, like sky and horse and tiger. You've got things which may have functions or purposes, such as a computer, or maybe a lie. It doesn't have to be an actual entity. It can be a proposition that has some purpose. And then you have these things called dot objects, complex types, which I'll talk about. So, and these have different types of semi-lattice structures. And this is pretty well understood. The thing about this is because of functional typing, the verbs and the adjectives or anything that basically selects for these things will be typed by virtue of functional typing as selecting an argument of that type. So you don't need a separate typing system for verbs as with any functional language. So touching, falling, being underneath, anything that's referring to natural objects is a natural verb. And artifactual entity types, again, beer, knife, house, things that have purposes. They're basically colored with a little, call it a theta roll or a qualia structure, okay, as a tensor. It's just a typing sugar. If that's the case, then certain predicates, I think my pants are making, oh, it's not me. Verbs can also be functional, artifactual predicates. Now, here's where things get interesting. Like fixing and spoiling can only apply, according to the theory, to things that would have a purpose. So water is not going to spoil unless you were going to do something with it. You can't fix something if it's just like a rock unless you wanted to do something with the rock. So the general claim, looking at data, would be that there's going to be some difference in how these things distribute. Now we come to dot objects or complex types. These are things which seem to glue together otherwise inconsistent or contradictory things, like my lecture being the event and the content, or the lunch we had and the food that we had at the lunch. These are the lexicalization, the lexical reification conceptually of contradictory types. A lot of examples such as these, and one way to test this is through co-predication that I'm not going to go through. I'm sure you've heard of these things. So lectures can be events and informational. Attribute value pairs such as temperatures are also considered dot objects in this model, and so on and so forth. There are a lot of them. Languages have huge varieties of these things. One of my favorite, for example, would be the classification by Linnaeus took 25 years, right? And the classification contains 12,100 species. So that's actually just a process result ambiguity, but it's a polysemy. These are all polysemies. And the classification is actually the lexicalization of this polysemy as encoding both types. They have different individuation principles, which I've studied with Asher. You can read every book in the library, and you could steal every book in the library, but there's going to be different numbers. There may only be one book. It's 500 copies of one novel. But to steal every book, you have to actually steal every book. You can read every book if you've just read the one copy. Okay, this is well understood. Now, as a result of this type of typing, there's also predicates that actually select for these complex types, like read. So read a book actually selects for the natural selecting type is actually a complex type. Now, does read show up? So one interesting question from a corpus is, is that actually the normal type that you see as an argument to the verb read and other types of predicates? Now let's get to the data. So given all this, we basically have function application, which would be type matching. And then we have a lot of ways of basically getting around not having the right type. One essentially is to do just classic type accommodation. Just go look for a type in my supertype. One, and then two real serious coercions. One is a wrapper. I create a wrapper over you. Or one is I pull something up from your internal type structure. And those are called introduction and exploitation, respectively. Just as an example, this is basic function application. Deny a statement. A statement is a proposition. A ball is a physical object. A rumor is a proposition. These are all fine in our theoretical, naturally elicited data set. And here's how the rock falls, is basically a selection. Here's a second order selection of an artifactual type. And here's a third order selection, namely a dot type. So these are all basically understood. Okay. Now you can coerce. And I'm not going to go into the details of coercions because we're going to see those. So water spoiling is acceptable if I'm going to do something with the water. So there has to be some tensor value. That is, it's got to be for something, an experiment. For example. Okay, a rumor is just some information that's floating around. It doesn't have to be physically manifested. But if I read it, I've just made it physically manifested someplace, on the web, on a wall, and so on and so forth, with classic aspectual coercions and event coercions. Okay, so this basically gives a kind of huge composition table of what you can do to get from one type to the next. I can talk about this later. Now, in work that I started with Elisabetha Jezsik and continue with Anna Rumschitzky and Patrick, we started looking at corpus distributions and behavior. So assuming a theory has some kind of type structure, and a computational operations of coercion that I just went over, what do you actually see in a real corpus? And what are the distributions of the different compositional mechanisms? Well, so let's look at the dot exploitation. In dot exploitation, the mechanism theoretically is I've got some complex type, A dot B, okay? So physical informational. If you're clear on the dot object construction, then exploitation of a dot element is to be able to pull out, do a selection, and say, I'm going to use, for the purposes of function application satisfaction, I'm going to take the type of the A or B, okay? So it's like select the first or second element of this thing and let the computation proceed. So verbs that actually would select for the first element of the dot, physical, will be like close and open, shut, et cetera, et cetera. And then things which are operating on physical inherently, like grab, pile, store, shelve, these all show up in the BNC corpus that we looked at, and the N1010 corpus on Sketch Engine. The second element, namely this propositional informational content, seems to be exploited or selected by verbs like ban, consult, edit, study, and so on and so forth. And here are just some examples. So you can discuss the new book, right? And we know that to be discussing the content as opposed to discussing the physical layout or the actual object, okay? Again, you could be in an editorial decision meeting for the cover for the new book, and you could be discussing the actual physical layout. So you could be discussing the book, and it could be the physical layout, but that's not the interpretation here. Another, so houses are also things that are locations but physical, so the you can build them, buy them, et cetera, et cetera. So these are essentially giving me, in terms of frequency, the most common verb-object pairs and for a particular dot element interpretation. And these are some examples of that. How does this work for other types, like speech? Event info, I have an event is going to be both the event but also the information. So here's a nice pairing example. He was forced to interrupt his speech because of some random noise. Or you can condemn a speech. Condemning the speech is clearly the content, the informational content that's being expressed during the event. And exit is also kind of interesting. It's an event and a location. So block an exit versus make an exit. So not every language has the same patterning of dot objects, but and looking at it cross-linguistically actually would, I believe, if you want to map it to other sorts of representations which could be helpful in terms of graphical modeling for, let's say, AMR, it would be interesting to see if this correlates with other semantic and syntactic patterning in the languages that you're actually looking at for, let's say, for MT purposes. All right, what these previous examples show is, I think, interesting, that single aspects of a dot are often picked up separately, and many items which are typed as dots tend to show up in text in just one of their aspects instead of both. So this is maybe not as consistent, although there were many exceptions, but to the 1 cent per text, for example, to paraphrase Yarovsky's thesis. Maybe there's one dot element for a dot object for a particular type of context or sense, of context. Now, but there's also, as pointed out by Jezik and Alessandro Lenci, using the same strategies and same methodology, there are some asymmetries with respect to the position of the complex type. For example, things that are books and physical object information. So the Italian articolo combines more frequently with information selectors rather than physical selectors, as given in the data right here. And so these are really interesting, and we tend to think that these are not symmetric, and the frequencies with which one can interpret or must interpret the one interpretation versus the other, I think will give us a better idea of what kind of object is this, and the distribution should reflect and tell us more about the semantics of the relationship which is actually encoding these two semantic elements. That's supposed to be a title, not name. They also noticed that lexical items realized the same dot object exhibit interesting variations. So for example, novel avoids the physical sense more than libro, book, does. And that also seems to occur in English as well. Novels don't tend to be manipulated physically as much as objects, such as books. So the asymmetry can be a property of some dots regardless of what argument they occupy. So for example, both door and gate, which have this dot object physical aperture interpretation, show preference for the physical interpretation in almost all arguments. So if you were looking at the corpus, you'd see predominantly physical manifestation of the dot object. But with very specific predicates, such as pass and enter and block and go through, you're going to get the aperture. So this leads one to think, well, let's look at the other example too. So in the subject position, opening, slamming, all these are physical. And the aperture, lead, go, so this door leads to the coffee room. So although these are polysemous in a logical way and have dot object status formally in the algebra of dot objects, are they legitimately dot objects? Should a distributional model be able to tease these apart and say perhaps even that the one interpretation is derived from the other? Maybe it's just physical, and you just has a hidden default argument that basically says you've got to be an aperture. There's an aperture someplace if you do something to this physical object. This has serious consequences for the theory. Interview shows distinct preferences for the event interpretation. I've got the numbers for all this. I just didn't want to go through all the data. So interview, although it can be informational, I disagree with the interview, or let's discuss the interview, whatever you might think could be good, in the data, you tend to get event interpretations. Conduct, give, analyze, describe. Continue, begin. So aspectuals are always, of course. So what's interesting about this is that the last point, asymmetries of corpus use can be seen as another diagnostic in addition to co-predication for identifying dot objects. So right now, in the community, in semantics, there really aren't a lot of diagnostics for except co-predication. Okay, continuing on, Finnish basically takes these events, but the classic kind of coercions of finishing a wine or finishing a beer, you can also finish the penicillin. These are naturally occurring cases. This is exploiting the content of the actual object in the position. Now, finishing a beer or a wine is looking at what I do with the drink. Finishing the penicillin is using the penicillin for whatever you use penicillin for. You're not drinking it. So, it is the case that naturals tend not to show up as objects of finish. This confirms basically the prediction of the model. They're simple types with no tensor. And they also don't show up with aspectuals very much. So what you get for things like last, for example, are events, and they're event nominals, really, mostly. Marriage, trial, siege, war. But you do get some artifactuals, like the battery lasts 24 hours, things like that. So what we call weak coercive verbs are non-aspectual event selectors, such as attend and avoid, which are really interesting semantically. So to attend a meeting, to attend a wedding. But avoid is really interesting because avoid, it's always selected in prop bank or in frame net and most semantic typing as taking an individual, but it's an event. So you have to kind of reconstruct what the event is. If you're avoiding a friend or avoiding fried food, what do you do with food? You're avoiding eating it. You're not trying to avoid going around it because you don't want to touch it. So it's a coercion. It's really interesting. Finally, let me just go into this other exploration of how selection is impacted by the coercion, by the distributional data coming from corpus studies. And that's work with Anna Rumshisky that started in 2008, and we've started anew recently. So again, we're trying to look at, start off with a theory-driven set of naturally elicited data, and then look at how the naturally observed data can contradict a theory, and then what revisions are necessary. So we had two case studies with a couple of theses. Verb selecting for artifactual entities, I talked about this a little bit. Natural types are not selected by artifactual predicates without coercion. Okay, so that would be, you're not going to touch, you're not going to repair a rock. Okay, you're not going to break a, whatever, water. Or mend water, with all associates being satisfied. So you have touch, which we already talked about. Repair has this reference to the fact that you're typing the object as something which has a function. So it's actually kind of, it's the typing of the object. It's a functional object, okay? So what shows up? Repair a roof, fix the computer, fix the sink, mend the fence, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so the prediction is naturally typed NPs should not appear as objects of artifactual predicates, except under coercion. The second case study, coercion allows dot objects to appear in propositional argument selections. I just told you about that. But specifically, you got propositional attitude verbs like believe and know, but then I want to look at the coercions. So I'm going to do a dot object exploitation in book. Believe the book. Tell me a lie. Realize the truth. So, and we already saw that, okay? So here's an example of that, having to exploit both. If I've memorized, then burned the book, I'm memorizing the information and then doing something to the physical manifestation of the book. Well, what you get is interesting. This is from BNC for repair. So going back to repair, remember I said you shouldn't have repair sticks or repair rocks and things like that. And what you get as the most meaningful object nominals are these qualitative descriptive nouns that carry this negative bad connotation, such as damage. But then you get objects which have clear artifactual meanings like roof and fence. And you don't really get anything that is natural in type. So from analyzing this organic data with the behavior of the verbs like fix and repair and mend, there are sort of two selectional clusters. There's this artifactual and then basically a negative state. And the negative state kind of breaks into two kind of subclusters, namely a condition on the artifact and then a general situation, like we got a problem, we're going to fix the problem. Then you have this other, the first one, the negative state, is something which might be particular to a kind of thing, like a leak. So a computer is not going to leak if you're lucky. But so there's two kinds of negative clusters. Repair does the same thing. Mend does the same thing. It's kind of interesting. So we had to modify our theoretical assumptions that there's a general negative situation and there's the conditions of the artifact. It's actually making reference to what the general negative situation is relative to the artifact that you're actually putting into that position. So that's really allows you to capture a broader range of the cement of the actual distributional data with less theoretical machinery that I won't go into right now. Okay, so the second one, let me just really quickly talk about the believe. What can you believe? Well, besides believe your luck and these others, believe my own ears, these things which we can discount, you don't really get books. Books not there, really. And much to my surprise and chagrin, these things which I'd been using as examples, keystone examples for 20 years, just don't exist. So what you do get are things which are, if they're physical, they're smaller and more focused and more directed in their content. And thinking it through, if you think about believe, what this actually then makes you want to go and reconsider is a sort of view that's taken in situation semantics, where It's not just a propositional attitude, it's a directed attitude towards something which can be true or false. You're holding a position. And it's not just a proposition. It's an attitude towards a position. And that's what believe is. So I can't believe a dictionary. That should be possible. So what this is forcing us to do in the type theory is to then go back and say, well, what is believe really selecting? These are the data. So if we have the data reflecting what the typing is, even distributionally, then it should at least show up. And it's just not. It's predictably not showing up. Okay. Well, I'm going to just go through the closing remarks because I'm taking too much time. If you have any questions, I can go into the details. So there's this inherent tension between corpus data and theory that I've only glossed over because I wanted to kind of give a more general discussion of this. What we need to account for in a probabilistic semantics is polysemy as one major component. That's not it. There's a lot of things to do. There's interpretations of quantificational scope, generics, many other things having to do with modality. But polysemy is a really major problem, which is really difficult given the nature of the way you build your models in distributional theories. So what I have are data suggestive of what might be an approach to go towards having probabilistic types. I haven't presented any solutions because I haven't started working on probabilistic type theory. Coercion, I think, it lends itself naturally to modulation and licensing, which I think can only be modeled through distributional methods. And so I think this is what we're going to need for general if we want to maintain compositionality. And so all of these compositional operations, which I've been talking about, will have to be modulated and be inherently probabilistic. So the probabilistic conditions will be part of the actual mechanism for compositionality, a la the people mentioned before, such as Shalom's work. Okay, that's all I have to say. Thanks. Questions? Jason?
I've got a bunch of questions, and maybe I'll ask you some of them later because some of them have to do with possible other ways to do things in the course of trying to probabilize. But let me just ask one or two simple ones. So I am trying to understand the need for dot types. I wondered about this when reading your paper on this as well. And why it's necessary to have those and not just do everything by coercion. So are you saying that there are some info objects which are not phys info, and we know this because you can't co-predicate of them or something?
Okay, so if you take the canonical dot object book, then the question is, why can't you start off with a base form, which is one or the other, and then just wrap it with a function that says, I'm the physical manifestation of this information, or I'm the informational content of this physical container, of this container. And you can do that, but what you need to do is to have the ability to keep everything around. It's a matter of one of these is going to be a wall, a light. Oh, that's good enough, right? So I'll have something which will be, let's say, underlyingly physical. And then I have to take something which is going to be a function which is going to be over the physical, and I would interpret that to be informational, right? Okay, or the inverse. There are contexts, many contexts, where you seem to need to keep track, and you can do it carefully if you want, where I have essentially reference to both. So the simplest example that I... So if I take Burn an Interesting Book, all right, I can take this to be functionally giving rise to some sort of informational content, and the actual selection to be something which is going to be typed as physical. So this is going to give rise, the output's going to be informational. Okay? And I don't have any problem with that, as long as what you're getting at the logical form is going to be something that's going to connect the two objects by some kind of relationship, that there is some container and there, the Y is contained in X or something like that. Okay? And that is actually one solution that's been proposed. I've proposed that myself. Or the first solution I gave was actually for that. So it's clear what you can't do if you take your type theory seriously. They can't be a join. It can't be a meet and it can't be a join. If you take certain assumptions for what you want the rest of your type theory to do. So what the dot object is doing is introducing new operations. And what Asher and I, and then now Asher in the 2011 book does very elegantly, is he takes kind of Martin Luf notion of dependent types. And everything is essentially a dependent type. Recently, I've been trying to get rid of dots, again, because I don't really like them. I kind of coined the term, but I don't really like them because they're really hard to compute with. And I'm thinking of them as nominal situations. So here's what I've been thinking about. You asked the question, if I can just have the liberty to talk about it for 30 seconds. So a Davidsonian view of events, even though I don't actually buy Davidson's view of events, is a very, very nice way to reason in first order. So, and I'm not going to rehearse it, but what you can do for something like a book and everything that has this kind of property, basically say that it's a dot and then just introduce the parameter structures or the theta roles or the event roles for book just as you would for an event. So I basically take this D to be an object which could live under the eventualities hierarchy in an ontology, and then say that the first argument of D is going to be this X. And the second argument of this D is going to be a Y. And then you can type them later. One is physical, one is informational. And that's going to be, so I can refer to this, so I can refer to the X, and I can refer to Y. And all the information is packed in there. Effectively, that allows you to kind of do what you were saying here while still keeping it as a kind of an individuated object.
Sure, or it could be asymmetric, where you say a book is a physical object that contains an informational object as a subfield.
And I think it's important to bring that point out. Namely, why would one want to do this if all the others are available options? One, it's computationally simpler. Two, it may lend itself to the actual distributional effects more readily, which I think is a very important concern. That's why I'm interested in the distributional data. I think there are more asymmetries than we think there are, and I think it's probably better to just derive some of these and just have them not even be dots underlyingly. Yeah. Did I sort of answer your question?
Yeah, you did. I have a follow-up, but let me give somebody else a chance.
Okay.
I was just wondering, so it seems like there's, I guess, several forms of polysemy. So, you know, bank has the financial and river versions, but...
That would be homonymy. I wouldn't call that polysemy.
Okay. Yeah. So, but does that kind of interact with your notion of, I guess, having processing results, apertures, and, you know, physical objects?
No, I think... I think I would follow Uriel Weinreich's original classification from his criticisms of the Webster's Third Dictionary, if you know that, or you should go read it. It's a really, really nasty criticism of a dictionary that is one of Patrick Hanks's favorite books and reviews. And he makes this distinction in the review, that which he then exploits quite a bit in his explorations in semantic space from like 1968, of contrastive versus complementary polysemy. The book, the bank example, is the contrastive. And that's what most linguists would just call homonymy, right? The complementary is what you might imagine the word means. And that's what I basically take to be, and Aprisian would also take to be, kind of the logical or systematic polysemy. So to get to your question, like book and book, you know, or bank the institution and bank the building that houses the institution, right? I think that they are probably conceptually and maybe even kind of formally different record structures or lexemes in the mental lexicon, the two meanings of bank. So I think contrastive polysemy, I think, doesn't enter into the same problem. What you still do have problems with is you have ambiguity, right? There's definitely ambiguity with contrastive word senses. So this isn't to say that it's trivial. We know it's not trivial. It's just that I think the solution for it, how one would go about accounting for it, I would think would actually look different. Do you think otherwise?
So I guess maybe bank is a kind of extreme example, but there, what about like, I don't know, sink or something, where it seems like there's, you know, there's physical sinks and there's things which are like, I don't know, like a heat sink, and then there's an abstract notion. It seems like, I guess, things are definitely connected somehow, and it's not just like independent, you know, senses.
Are you thinking of whether or not the polysemy or the two senses in one of these dots is different than or related to, let's say, metaphorical extension, for example? So in the sink example, that brings up a really difficult question, right? Because I think there are metaphorical extensions that need to be accounted for in that I don't think would be modeled as a dot object.
I guess I'm just trying to understand the space, whether it's some things are dots, some things are
collections. Okay, so
things are metaphorical.
They're actually syntactically identifiable.
Okay.
So, and usually in discourse, and very often in the same phrase. So, I've got my rucksack. I've been in Europe too long. I've got my backpack, and my lunch is in the backpack, right? And then later on, I'm at lunch, and the phone call. I get a phone call, or I get a text, right? It's the same word, the same. It's the same lexeme. Okay, so it's an ambiguity. No, they're semantically related. And that's a very different type of semantic relation than the book. So there are container dot objects where it's kind of sine qua non. I can't have one without the other, at least originally in the notion of when writing first came in to a language as expressed through the language. Now we have blank books that have no information. But the lunch example of being the food versus the actual eventuality of the eating, which involves the food, is a different kind of involvement. Of the one element in the other. That's why, to go back to answering Jason's question, treating things more along a situational or eventuality way actually tends to be interesting to me because it makes those types of dot objects look more like something else, but they're still dots because you've generalized the notion of a dot. So to answer your question, there are syntactic and then semantic, namely copredication and zeugma type tests, which are traditionally used to identify something as a dot object. But it's still pretty fuzzy, and not everyone can agree on
it. So just to clarify, coercion and metaphorical extension are different?
So coercion is completely dependent on the richness of the type system you have. So if you've got a very richly typed language, you may not need to do coercion anywhere. So, and in fact, for classifier languages that do all the work through classification of a particular nominal system, like Aboriginal languages, there's no coercion. They're monomorphic predicates. You don't eat the same kangaroo that you see walking around in the field, right? They're different verbs, obviously, but they're different noun constructions because you've made it food kangaroo versus walking around kangaroo. So coercion is really dependent on the whole syntax of the language. Metaphor is an entirely different beast that I cannot even begin to address right now. But it's one of the important questions to ask.
Would it be an appropriate paraphrase to say that the metaphorical extension of sync has nothing to do with the verbs that are applied to a particular setting, that it's sort of inherent to sync, that it was extended that way through historical use or something like that?
Yes. Yes. That's right. And of course, there are linguists and semanticists who've looked at what constructions and lexis network tend to come along for the ride with a metaphorical extension. And and that's all the way back to Black's work on metaphor from the 60s. But certainly Lakoff did that. And And so the lexis, the sublexis that might go along with sync, it doesn't not with sync so much as maybe other language, other type. Motion verbs do that a lot, right? They bring along all the network of the lexis. By lexis, I mean the sub-vocabulary that goes along with the extended sense. So yeah. Dan?
So I was wondering, so we don't really have any traditionally minded semanticists here, so I'll play one for
us.
So I was wondering...
Speak with a German accent.
Yeah, right. So I was wondering, you know, once I probabilize meaning shifts in the way you're describing, I worry that I'm recapitulating a whole lot of what people know about the world very generally in my lexicon. So that I'm essentially doubling up on how much information I have to store about the kinds of participation, you know, the relations that hold between individuals and so forth. So I guess one is that, do you think that's problematic, or is the distinction between lexicon and theory of the world a serious theoretical distinction, or just a convenience for you?
Right, that's a great question. I don't know how to answer that exactly. For now, it's been a convenience in terms of helping me think through the data. I'm tending to think maybe Shalom is right, that maybe you don't need the models. And that's one way to get around your question, your problem. So you just treat you don't need the possible worlds in the model. And that's the reason you get such computational explosions with the computing the possible worlds for all the different distributions, right? So I don't know, because I really don't understand his model yet. I can't say whether I can't believe it or not believe it, because I don't understand it yet. So, but that's the key question. I'm hoping to maybe learn more about that this week. What do you think? Did you have an answer to that question?
I think it's just personally, I would say that the distinction between lexicon and everything else we know about the world is a theoretical convenience and not a deep commitment. But you know, most people would not agree with me in my field, I suspect.
But the consequences of it being a theoretical, just a convenience, then
is that your theory of meaning, word meaning, and your theory of everything else about the world is a continuous space. It's
not. But then, what do you say to Shalom's criticism about the possible world space explosion for the doing interpretations probabilistically?
Okay. Well, let's talk about that.
Okay. No, I'm not trying to put you on the spot, because I really want to know if you've got a way to work that out. Okay. Yeah. Then, to put that way, I might actually agree with you. Not that that's hard to believe. I might agree with the way you put it, that I don't see there is this big distinction between lexical information and lexical probabilities and then everything else. Yeah. In fact, I like that.
Okay.